Hello and welcome to our discussion of Advanced Higher Classical Studies Option History and Historiography. I'm Andy McKellar, I'm the PA for the subject, and I'm delighted to be joined by Lee Baker, and we're going to discuss this theme or this topic and the different authors involved in it, and also look ahead to how you might best prepare yourself to answer the questions in the exam.
Thanks, Andy. So I think we'd be starting off with a discussion about what does history and historiography actually mean? Because I suspect most people will know what history is, but might be a bit unsure about historiography.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's the historiography bit that really is of interest in terms of the relevance for this particular topic. Historiography literally means the writing of history. So history, as you say, we all kind of know what it means. It means sort of understanding what was going on in the past. But tied to our study of history should be our awareness that the way in which history is told will shape the view that we actually have of it. And so that is why we're both learning about key elements in world history when we're studying this topic, but also learning about the different ways and approaches that the historians that we study took and why they took those and what the impact is of that and how that maybe leads the reader to interpret things in particular ways. And I think it's fascinating for modern pupils to realize that the way a story is told, whether it's history or not, is actually going to shade the way in which you identify with the story itself, the characters involved, what's right and what's wrong, and things like that. That very much the way it's told has so much impact, really.
So that sounds pretty big. You know, massive themes that you're going to be tackling, or the potential to tackle within this topic. What authors are on the prescription lists for studying these aspects of ancient history?
Well, it's a full range throughout the sort of key areas of the classical world, and they're all the big names from history. We start with Herodotus, known as the father of history, also known as the father of lies. And as we study him, we look at the reasons for both of those things. Prior to Herodotus's writing, history had really been understood in a kind of mythological way. People had looked to the myths, they'd looked to Homer particularly as telling them about, you know, their past and where they came from. And it's quite fascinating that at the beginning of Herodotus's history, he actually refers to the myths as a way of kind of indicating the early history of the Greek people, as if that was the normal way to explore where they'd actually been as people. But then what he does, which is revolutionary at the time, is he then writes very detailed prose descriptions of all the important areas of the world he then wants to talk about. So his focus is on the Greek and Persian wars, which in itself obviously is a vitally important kind of turning point in history. Had the Greek city-states not repelled the Persian Empire at the time when they did, the world would be just a very, very different place. It's inevitably, whether for good or bad, we just don't know. But there would have been no flourishing Athenian democracy, which probably means there would have been no flourishing classical Athens to lend its ideas to Rome and then to shape the whole of European history after that and world history after that. It genuinely is a turning point in world history. And the way Herodotus explores it is by beginning with trying to establish who the Persians are as a people, who the Athenians and the Spartans are as people. And he does that by telling stories about the stories that he can tell about, you know, how they came into power, about the way they're governed and what their values were, before he then leads gradually into a more detailed description of the events leading up to the Persian Wars. And then a really strong focus towards the end of his work on the specific years when the major events in the war took place. And we look at the first book, which does this background, focusing largely on Persia, but also detailing the sort of early-ish phases in Athenian and Spartan history. And then we look again at a later book, which actually focuses directly on the invasion, which led up to the Battle of Marathon. After Herodotus, we have Thucydides. And Thucydides details a slightly later point in Greek history, which was the war that was fought between Athens and Sparta, quite close to a sort of world war in sort of Greek terms. And his history is one of the most amazing pieces of political history ever written. And it's still regarded as that, you know, scholars of politics not only classics, will actually look to it as an incredibly incisive way of explaining the sort of motivations that leaders in different states will have and what motivates them to carry out particular actions.
Well, that all sounds like so much. That's just the first two authors of the course. But, you know, it's like all things, you know, once you start unpicking it, you see how big these ideas are, even though these writers can do it in a really condensed way. They can fit into quite a short number of lines, these huge ideas that are sort of politically explosive. So we've got Herodotus and Thucydides. There's Polybius, Livy and Tacitus as well. So how do they deal with the Roman side of things rather than the Greek side?
Absolutely. Polybius is a Greek writer, but he was taken to Rome, actually, at the point when the Romans were rising to power in the Mediterranean world. And so he spent his time in Rome itself. And so he was very close to high-ranking Roman officials. And he had access to the top people in the Republic and the kind of documents that told the story of how the Roman Republic had really developed itself from a smallish state. We think of the Romans and think of the Roman Empire, the sort of super state, but it just began as a city, which gradually grew. But there was an incredible period of 53 years, and Polybius stresses this, during which the Romans moved from being this expansionist state in the middle of Italy to actually dominating the entire Mediterranean coastline. And once again, it's just a huge turning point in history. Rome was in conflict with the North African power, the city of Carthage. And Carthage looked like the more powerful of the two initially. And there was about a century of war between them. The early stages were a fairly small-scale affair centred around Sicily. But it set the stage for this incredible half-century where Rome was able to actually come to dominate, because Carthage, in an attempt to avenge its loss in the First Punic War, mounted a huge invasion of Rome itself, which, for various different reasons, drew in actors from all across the Mediterranean world. Now, Rome prevailed. And because they had prevailed in that war, they had, in a sense, defeated all these different powers that had been drawn in all across the Mediterranean world. And they suddenly were in charge of the whole Mediterranean. And just as the victory of the Athenians meant that history would take a particular turn after the Persian Wars, the victory of the Romans meant that Rome would shape the future history of Europe. Had Rome lost these wars, which they could easily have done, then a North African city would actually have been the city that dominated this part of the world. And it's fascinating to think, what might history be like if the seat of world power had not been Europe, but had been North Africa? We just can't know, but it would be amazing to consider. Livy tackles the rise of Rome, but he goes right back to ancient history as far as the Romans were concerned. He goes back to the time of the kings itself, when it's largely legend. They don't really know much in the way of historical detail. They know what must have happened in order for Rome to become the city it grew into by Republican times, when there were sort of genuine records. But they didn't really know how it happened, and legends grew up about how each of the kings brought different aspects to Roman society to enable it to be a fully flourishing society by the time the Republic was established. We have this canonical group of seven kings, each of them with implausibly long reigns. So the likelihood is, in sort of royal terms, there was probably more than seven kings. But each of these kings are given good substantial reigns, and they kind of each stand for a particular aspect of Roman life which was developed. Romulus is like a legendary hero. He's like a superhero in a way, like a kind of Robin Hood figure initially, when he sort of avenges his mother and overthrows his wicked uncle, founds the city and leads it as a hero king, and then eventually he's deified at the end. He mysteriously goes up to heaven at the end. Numa, who follows him, is the king who brings a proper respect for religion to the city. Tullus Hostilius, who comes afterwards, is the king who adds a kind of more militaristic aspect of the Roman people begins the idea of expansion throughout the area of Latium. The Latin League is formed. And the end point of the kings is a conflict between the native Latins and the Etruscans. And the Etruscans are a people to the north of Italy who were always looked on as the kind of the boogeymen, the enemy, the enemy within by the Romans. But in reality, you know, they will have just been part of the colonists at the same time. But the Latins and the Etruscans presumably stopped getting on, and the Etruscans were expelled, as it were, from the city. And throughout the early periods of the Republic that follows that, Rome's main enemy are the Etruscans to the north. And then we've got Tacitus right at the end of our sequence, who is an incredibly talented historian who is discussing the empire, but he's at a relatively late period in time in the empire compared to the rest of the stuff that we're looking at. So he focuses on the emperor Tiberius, who's the second emperor, and also the emperor Nero, or the text that we look at, rather. He deals with all the emperors through from Tiberius. So we have, in the time of Tiberius, it's quite fascinating. Tacitus is writing from the time of Domitian, in fact, much later, when the Senate is essentially a group of puppets terrified by the tyrannical ruler. And so he reads that idea back into the history of the early emperors as well. So when he tells us about Tiberius, he's excellent at telling us the details of what was going on. But sometimes it's fascinating that the interpretations he gives of the events are just really coloured. He can't see Tiberius doing anything without a wicked motive behind it. Even to the point when Tiberius does something helpful, Tacitus will sort of say, and of course he did this just to pretend he wasn't a tyrant at heart. And when he gets to Nero, you know, a few emperors later, we've got to a stage then when we genuinely are seeing a tyrant in the making. Nero, fascinating figure again. He ruled for quite a long time. He was a young guy, and initially he was kind of growing into what could have been a good emperor. But he has a turning point in his early adulthood when he suddenly violently turns against all those people who've been guiding him and keeping him in check. And some awful stories throughout Book 14 about how he removes all these constraints on his power and grows into a pure tyrannical emperor by the end.
Gosh, almost sounds a bit like watching a soap opera, doesn't it? Look,
absolutely, yeah.
So lots of these texts containing quite a range of different classical periods, classical issues. What would your advice be to pupils in order to prepare for the exam, boost the quality of their answer, and possibly even how to organise their thinking in terms of these texts?
Well, I think the aspects of study are really useful for pupils to get a sense of, again, how to prepare themselves for the exam. As you so rightly say, Lee, there's just a phenomenal number of things going on in all of these texts. So we're not expecting a detailed awareness of everything that happens in all of these texts. That would be ludicrous. So we give aspects of study and just ask them to be able to address how these might impact on thinking about particular texts. So, for example, attitudes to evidence. So the candidate should maybe think about, okay, go through each of the authors in turn. Herodotus, what's his attitude to evidence? Well, I mean, it's not terribly critical. He tends to give us as many different stories as he's heard and kind of leave us to sort of work out, in a lot of senses, what might be the correct interpretation. He's kind of famous for the sort of digressions that he makes, telling us about this, that and the other. This is what led him to be called the kind of father of lies, because so many of the stories he tells us, we think that can't possibly be true. We've got the way in which material is arranged. I've just mentioned that the fact that Herodotus arranges it in this mode of digression. Thucydides takes a much more analytical approach, but he goes sort of almost year by year through the war. He makes a terrific use of set speeches as a way of trying to give his impressions of why things were happening the way they were. He kind of famously comments that he's going to write down speeches as accurate to what was said or to what should be said or what would have been said or should have been said. So it gives us this sense that he's actually using the speeches to try and explain why the events happened the way they did. And we can't really know how far those speeches really match what was said or how far their interpretations of Thucydides himself. Polybius takes the analytical route and runs with it even further. He goes into great detail about the treaties that had existed between Rome and Carthage and tries to analyse how far in breach of treaties the different parties were. And then with soap opera was a very nice way to describe Tacitus's approach. And Livy, of course, is almost in a way, he's like Homer in a sense. He's describing the legends. And at the beginning of his book, he makes no bones about the idea that's what he's going to do, because he thinks the Romans deserve to be celebrated with legends. We also have to think about the purpose. Why are they telling their stories in the way they are? Tacitus, as I mentioned already, wants to make points about bias quite prominently. Herodotus wants to explore whether there's a difference in the nature of the peoples of Persia and the peoples of Greece, and whether, you know, the way they're ruled impacts on the way what their expectations and how capable they are of meeting challenges and so on. So if the pupils just get themselves prepared to answer on these aspects, if they think, right, I can say something about these aspects relevant to all of the different authors, then again, they'll be fully prepared to answer anything that might be asked in the exam.
Brilliant. Gosh, I wish you could just go back, and I'm quite jealous of these pupils who just are getting to experience this for the first time and come across all these characters that a seasoned classicist will know about. But if you're meeting this for the first time, it must be quite something.
Yeah, that's always a nice way to think of it. Yeah. Well, thanks very much. That was a great discussion. Thank you for listening to our discussion there. And please do join us for the other Advanced Higher Options, Comedy, Satire and Society, Heroes and Heroism, and Individual and Community.